Welcome to another episode of Pat and the Fat Man. We like to talk about movies, sports, and whatever else we feel like. I'm Pat.
And I'm the Fat Man.
We're coming at you with our next movie.
Who Framed Roger Rabbit? Yeah. I was gonna say, I don't really think it has a theme, but
sort of like the sleazy 1920s, 1930s kind of music.
It starts off with that. It's like either a trombone. Yeah, a trombone. I wouldn't say saxophone, but it's definitely a horn. Wah, 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 wah. But it's got that Dick Tracy coming off the comic books, you know, noir detective thing, you know, 1940s, 1950s.
I assume it's set, the 30s maybe? Because it's after Prohibition.
1947.
It's set in 47, huh?
Yes.
Yeah, no, because we've got Fantasia. Like, there's a bunch of Disney stuff in this. All right, so.
I saw this when I was 4 years old. This came out in 1988. Yeah. I remember seeing this in the movie theater. Okay, and we're going to point out the things where you go, yeah, this was meant to get adults to come see a Disney movie.
Although it wasn't a Disney movie. It was Touchstone.
Didn't they own it?
Oh, I have no idea, to be honest.
They had to have a close partnership because of all the things that were Who Framed Roger Rabbit in the MGM Studios / Hollywood Studios theme park.
Yeah, that's true.
That they had in there for a very long time.
Yeah. All right, so Who Framed Roger Rabbit? First impressions of the Fat Man.
It's a great movie. Okay, maybe great is a little bit of a stretch, but it's a really good, fun movie. This is one of the things that makes Bob Hoskins such an underrated actor when he was alive, because I thought he did a magnificent job with this movie. The cinematography, all the little stuff that they did to make this movie work. Seeing it for the second time, you know, I guess today and a little before, maybe what you see on Disney Plus has been remastered, kind of brushed up. If not, then the CGI is fantastic for 1988.
It's not CGI.
Well, some of it is. I mean, some of it had to be because of the opening scene in and of itself.
No. They hand-painted frame by frame. They got guys and gals to paint the film frames.
Yeah, but there's so much of in that beginning that just looks too clean, too shiny when I was watching it. Like I said, maybe it's because it was remastered or whatever.
Yeah.
There's just a lot of really clean animation. Now, beyond that opening scene, yeah, I could see where it was painted and this, that, and the other
thing. Well, if you're talking about the scene where they were in
Baby Herman cartoon.
Baby Herman. Well, that was just animation.
It just looked awfully clean for me for you know, just animation.
Yeah, they may have touched it up, but that was just animation. That was just standard hand-drawn animation. I think one of the things that makes it seem cleaner is the time period in which it's set.
Oh, sure.
It would not have looked that clean on screen.
Right. This was very much a Dick Tracy, detective noir, straight off the comic book and onto the silver screen kind of movie. All the classic things are there. You know, a private detective gets in on a job and then turns out to be more than what he expected. So many characters in that they had to put in, or that they didn't have to, but that they did put in to make it very real. So many good jokes. Just the imagination of what it would be like if cartoons were real and amongst us kind of thing.
I thought this was, I think maybe great film is a little bit of a stretch, but on the other side of it, I don't think it is, because it's such a, it's a classic kind of movie, right? The film noir, the detective, you know, movie, and it follows all of the tropes of that genre so well, but then it's clashed in with this, I don't know if you'd call it either fairy tale or science fiction, but it kind of stands within those a conceit, right? So in most science fictions and fantasy worlds, you have a conceit that plays out and kind of makes the story what it is, right? In most science fiction, it's faster than light travel of some kind. That would make the story impossible to do if they didn't have that technology. In, for instance, Game of Thrones, the conceit is that, you know, the world seasons come in years. And so, you know, you get 10 years of summer in a row, you know, you have these conceits that make the world kind of what it is. You know, we figured out AI, or, you know, robots are a thing, or whatever it is. And, you know, the conceit of this movie is like cartoons are actually like real beings.
Right.
We don't go into how they're made, into how they exist.
How they come off the page to be quote unquote real.
You know, if they were drawings at first and somehow imbued with real life by, magic. There's no explanation of it.
Which is funny because they come close to that in one scene, you know, in Jessica Rabbit's most famous line, they come right up to that without telling you, you know?
Right. But it's not important to the story.
Right.
What's important to the story are the characters and that it plays out with these tunes. And we even go into Toontown at one point. Mm-hmm. I think the only other movie and or show that has a very similar conceit to this, can't remember the name of it, but it's the... There's a movie where a comic book artist gets pulled into his own world. Talking about
Cool World, I believe, with Val Kilmer.
Yeah, Cool World.
Which is a much more adult version of this.
Yes, way far more. And it's a different story altogether.
Yeah.
But it's the only one that comes close to this kind of mishmash of the world. And so it's hilarious because, like, if you really try to put any thought behind the conceit as it was, like, everything unravels very quickly. Mm-hmm. You're like, how would this really work? Why would they use tunes for show business and not for, like, all kinds of crazy things that they could do that humans couldn't?
Part of it, they did. I mean, that's where we end up having the femme fatale, how the kind of the plot kicker starts with Jessica Rabbit.
Yeah.
It wasn't in the studio and it wasn't for a movie.
But it's entertainment still. Like, you would, sure, you figure you would use tunes to, like, rescue deep sea divers or like do stuff that, you know, humans, that's impossible for humans to do, that kind of thing.
I guess.
But even with that conceit, it's still just a really well done show.
Oh, yeah.
I didn't even realize. Is it Bob Costa?
Hoskins. Bob Hoskins.
Hoskins. I don't know why I think Hoskins. Bob Hoskins. I didn't even realize he was British until, like, far later in life. Maybe in my 30s.
Right.
Like, I heard his real voice and I was like, that's not his real voice. His real voice is the one from Roger Rabbit.
He could have passed for a double of Phil Collins.
I know, right?
If Phil Collins is British, I mean, we knew that.
Yeah, that's true. I can
feel it coming in the air. Oh my god. A music video of this movie to that song would just work in so many different levels.
Hold on.
Like, right up there with that, you know, that how they clipped that song to, like, clips of Miami Vice.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
That was just Miami Vice. It was basically a music video in TV form.
And everybody in Hollywood was in that show.
Mm-hmm. All right. So, great movie. Fantastically executed. Ultimately, a film noir film set in, you know, Hollywood in the 1940s, right after the war. And tunes are real beings that interact in real life. And that's the movie. And it turns out to be just fantastic.
96 on Rotten Tomatoes.
Nobody dislikes this movie. 4%.
It's funny because when it's talked about, it's like, oh boy, that was one of the raciest movies that, you know, Disney ever did.
It wasn't just Disney, right? Because there's the Disney characters. And then you also have the Warner Brothers characters are in there as well.
They had originally planned, I remember seeing this clip on TikTok. They had planned on like a couple of Warner Brothers characters, like Bugs Bunny and Daffy Duck. They had to make a deal that they had to take all these other characters. And then also part of the deal to try to keep the cost down that they would have to pay to Warner Brothers is that anytime Warner Brothers character was on screen, it had to be paired with a Disney character.
Interesting.
And if you pay attention, and I thought about this, and if you pay attention, that's exactly what happens.
Which, I mean, honestly, leads to some amazing scenes.
Oh, yeah. Daffy and Donald scene for, like, oh. I mean, as the number one, I would think, in this movie is a Disney duo.
Yeah, Disney, Warner Brothers.
Yeah.
So let's dive into it.
So we start off the movie with a cartoon, almost like a pre-movie cartoon. And movies in the old days kind of did stuff like this for a while. Hollywood was doing this again kind of thing.
Yeah, Pixar still does, or used to do this.
Right. And this cartoon is in Something's Cooking, starring Baby Herman and Roger Rabbit. And in this story, yeah, Mom, who we never see her face, we just see her legs, as often like a Peanuts character, comes in, tells the baby, hey, I'm going out to the beauty salon and I've got your favorite babysitter, Roger Rabbit. He's going to look after you. Otherwise, he's going back to the laboratory.
To the science lab. That's such a great line. Like, what would be threatening to a rabbit? Solid. That or cosmetics factory, you know? To the science lab.
And so, of course, you know, Roger was like, I'm up to it. I'll do anything. I'll, you know, nothing will happen. And I got his back, yada, yada, yada. And he's, you know, all about pumping himself up. And as he's saying this, the baby, of course, escapes the playpen, shoots himself right into the kitchen. So that way he looks, and where, of course, is the cookie jar? Because when you got a cookie jar with an infant, you know, where do you put it? On top of the fridge? Because there's, you know, of course he'd be able to get on top of the freaking counter that's, you know, 10 feet above him.
Yeah, that's really more of a toddler problem. Once you get the ability to climb, then you're kind of hosed.
So, of course, the baby gets into the kitchen, somehow manages to open drawers and use them as stairs to get on top of the countertop. Roger Rabbit sees him and goes tearing after him. Of course, you know, like kind of running in place. As the baby's going through the kitchens, knocking this, that over, turning the stove on by accident.
Yeah.
Roger Rabbit comes in, you know, running on the rolling pin like it's like a, you know, freaking log dammer. lumberjack. And then the baby somehow manages to open the stove, and Roger Rabbit gets in the stove, and the baby turns it on high. And
to volcano.
Right, he
turns it to volcano. Yeah. There's so many wonderful TV animated Saturday morning cartoon tropes.
All of it wrapped again.
This is basically just, if you sat down and watched Tom and Jerry and the Warner Brothers and the Hanna-Barbera, and you just watched them all back to back to back for like 2 hours, this is just everything that happens in all of those condensed into a single little story.
And then it just culminates into this where Roger Rabbit ends up throwing himself into underneath the fridge. And in the process, trying to get the refrigerator off of him, gets the baby to fall onto his lap, and the baby gets the cookie and wanders off. And then, you know, as the Roger Rabbit, you know, realizes the fridge is too heavy, it lands hard on him. And then the refrigerator door magically opens, and like the cartoon character kind of being dazed, has birds flying around him.
Yeah.
And then at that moment, you hear cut, cut, cut. All of a sudden, sweet baby voice turns into basically a Danny DeVito type voice.
Yes.
Like a guy that's been a 20-year, 5-packs-a-day smoker kind of thing, you know?
Yep.
And he's like, what now? What is all this? And the director's like, no, you were great. You're fabulous.
What's wrong with it this time?
What was wrong with this time? Kermit, it's Roger. Roger, do you see here in the, you know, the script
that screwing up his lines.
He screwed up his lines. Right, it's a line, apparently.
Yeah.
And he goes, see, and he says, gets hit by refrigerator and sees stars, not birds, stars.
I could do stars for you. I could do stars. He was right after him, hitting himself in the head.
Yeah, that's
over
it for the day.
And over. And this is your introduction to the conceit of the story, right? The toons are actors. They're not drawn. And they exist in the same sort of actor realm as the rest of Hollywood. And the same setup is going. You've got the director who's got the, you know, kind of the plaid flannel cardigan. I don't know. and the you know, and the white pants and the hat. And he's got the bullhorn. And it's just like straight out of a trope for what a director, quote unquote, looks like. And he's yelling at people. All right, that's cut. Someone yell lunch. Lunch. That's lunch, everybody. You know, what it's doing is bringing you into the conceit as like quickly and as overwhelmingly as possible. So you just accept it. There's no like stopping to think about it. There's
otherwise you're going to get left behind.
Right. Exactly. And so you're suddenly in this world with Roger chasing after the director. I'll do better. I'll do better. Hitting himself on the head with the stuff showing up, and he can't get the stars to show up.
It's like a birdhouse, bells.
And we're not even going to talk about the fact that somehow he's created life by having these birds show up on top of his head. you know, we're just going to move past that. Why? Because it was funny. And the fact that the director cares at all that they're stars and not like that they're birds and not stars. Right. Like who?
That was my thing. Like, really? Like, is it, you really think the audience cares? Like, oh, the birds. I hate birds. Why isn't it stars? Like, really?
Yeah.
When I'm watching cartoons, I don't give a damn what's rolling around his head.
Exactly. And it's like he keeps messing up his line. So it's written in the line that he has to produce stars. Like, and it's such a great, like, you get to Bob, and he's standing there, and he's looking over it all, and he's just like,
tunes.
Tunes.
You know, as he takes a big swig of his pocket iced tea. Right? I mean, that man must love his tea to be carrying it around in his pocket like that.
He loves his tea.
Right?
Loves it.
I love tea too. I wish I loved tea that much.
Yeah, some days. Maybe tomorrow. I don't know. I just maybe I would be happier drunk at work. I don't know.
I wonder about that too. And I work from home, so it's not like they're going to test me. You know?
Would I be a better customer salesperson if I was drunk most of the time? What did you say the product name was? No, we don't have that. Oh, no, wait, what? No, oh, that's an L. Oh, what's an L? You got so drunk you forgot a letter of the alphabet. Hey, can you blame me?
Hey, you'd forget it too if you had this job.
Yeah, exactly. So, man, we got a little bit off track there. It's not shocking.
It's going to happen a lot in this movie, guys. We I'm enjoy sure this movie. So this is this might be a 5-episode gig.
Yeah.
So, yeah, Bob Hoskins' character comes in, walks into this movie executive's office. His name is R.K. Maroon.
R.K. Maroon.
Now, I couldn't figure if they were trying to spell something with that, but my guess is they were just going with maroon to kind of make it sound like, you know, moron. You know, what a maroon.
I think that's where they were going with it.
Yeah.
Because what's the name of the guy who ends up owning Toontown?
Well, it was Cloverleaf. That owned it before was Marvin Acme of Acme Industries.
Acme. So you got Maroon and Acme. You got these, you know, those kind of names being thrown out around here.
Well, Acme in particular, because I mean that's the stuff that all the tunes use in their cartoons, you know.
Right.
Acme Vacuum, Acme Dynamite, you know, the household things.
Right. The household things. Dynamite. Rocket boots. Rocket skates, sorry.
So yeah, Bob Hoskins comes in, the exec's talking to him, basically he's talking about how the cartoon we just saw is over budget by $25,000, and it's because, you know, Roger Rabbit can't get his line straight.
Yeah, I love how this scene starts, because it's like he comes in and it's Maroon and this other guy watching a little film reel going, and you know, the music playing, and it's just very, you know, Hollywood exec kind of overboard sort of going on there. What does he say? The first thing he says, you ever worked in show business?
You know anything about show business? He shoots back, only that there's no business like it. It's like no business that I know.
No business like show business.
Listen, you're not going to get picked up in Hollywood, Pat, all right? Just stop. End the dream.
I could get picked up. I mean, someone might want my kidney. You don't know. I could black out and end up waking up in a bathtub. I could get picked up in Hollywood.
Trade your kidney for a Hollywood contract.
I mean, it might be worth it. I only need one.
Yeah, but your drinking capacity would greatly be diminished.
Says you.
I think we've switched roles here.
Maybe we have. Glug, glug, glug. Glug, glug, glug. What is this? Dragonberry Bacardi. Cluck, cluck, cluck. I kind of want to do that now.
Fruit flavored liquor? What a child.
If I could come through the screen and bash you in the head with this bottle, I would. I would, sir.
What are you going to do? Kill me with diabetes?
I mean, I don't think I have to try too hard on that front, Bruce.
Hey, you, man.
You. Yeah, so there's no business like show business. There's no business more expensive than show business, is how Maroon says it. And it's such an interesting little like conceit that he sets up here. It's like, because Roger Rabbit can't get his lines right, and it's because of his wife.
Right.
And it's his wife is basically, he says she's no good. Roger's wife is no good, no good for him. And hints that she's all over town cheating on him, and that he's hiring our PI here to take a few pictures.
Really, the kind of thing that catches you first about this whole thing is Valiant says, get somebody else to do it because I don't do Toontown. And at first, Maroon's like, hey, what's wrong with Toontown? Every Joe likes Toontown. And he goes, well, get Joe to do it. And then Maroon kind of backpedals and goes, hey, you don't want to go to Toontown? You don't have to go to Toontown. No one said you had to go to Toontown. At this point, you realize that Valiant's got kind of a hiccup here. He sees that Maroon's got his own personal iced tea to drink and wants to take some of his iced tea and says, you know, that he'll do the job for $100. And at first, you know, Maroon balks at it because 1947, $100 is a lot of money. I can't do the conversion right now, but it's a lot
of money.
Pretty
sure it's close to $4.3 billion. After all of the inflation the government's caused.
Okay, we're not going to spend the 5 minutes to do that research. We'll come back on the next episode.
$1,468.
There you go. Thanks. Still, in today's money, it's what I make doing my minimum wage job. My God, things were cheap back then.
Yes. French dip for 50 cents. French dip for 50 cents. I was looking at that thing to myself. I'm like, today, it's like, what, $10?
Right.
$10 to $15 in most places. So, I mean, that's, yeah.
Yeah. Anyways, he said $100 plus expenses. And at first, he's like, what? And he's like, no, that's outrageous. And he's like, all right, you can get somebody else. Like, all right, fine. So as he's writing the check, it's at this point we have our first real human to cartoon interaction, because as Valiant's looking out the window, all of a sudden pops up Dumbo, Everybody's favorite flying elephant. He says that he had him on loan from Disney, him and a bunch of and like half the cast of Fantasia. And he goes, the best part is they work for peanuts. And he throws a bunch of peanuts out the window and, you know, Dumbo sucks him up in his trunk and goes flying away.
You know, as they did these scenes where there's interactions between real film and the drawing film, they had to be very careful about how they interacted with the animated characters, because the more open space, depending on where the shot was shot from and where the animated character was going to be, the more open space there was, the more intricate drawing work. So I remember watching a documentary where Bob was talking about how if he ever grabbed, you know, Roger Rabbit, like he grabs him around the neck one time, he had to be very careful to keep his fingers closed, because if he kept his fingers open, the animator would have to frame by frame draw Roger's neck in between his fingers.
Right.
And so they had to take that kind of stuff into account. You see that going forward as you watch Bob's movements through the next scene as he's, you know, kind of wandering through all of these tunes. You know, before we get there, you get the first intimation that there is a Toontown where the Toons supposedly live. And the second piece of information, which is important, and that is that it's well known that Valiant is a drunk. Because he doesn't even ask.
Drunk on iced tea. I mean, that's the kind of drunk I want to be.
Yeah, he doesn't even ask. He just gets up from the seat, right, walks behind the guy, and starts making himself a drink. And Maroon doesn't even stop him.
This is kind of like a power move, and like, oh, you really want me to do it? All right, try and stop me. I dare you to stop me from drinking your iced tea because you really want me to do this job. Let's see how much you want me to do this job.
And it's funny because he balks at the $100 initially and then, you know, ends up giving him $50 and a check. For those of you who are, you know, in your 20s, a check was a piece of paper that was issued by a bank that had your account number on it, as well as some other details.
Oh, man.
That you would write the amount of money you wanted the bank to transfer to whoever you were writing on the check. So you would write the person you wanted the money to go to and the amount. And this was before credit cards, I think, at all existed.
Yes, that would be correct.
Yeah. And so this was a way to give somebody money without handing them money, effectively. Unless you happen to write the word cash on the check, and then it was, you know, as good as money.
And for the love of God, if you're listening to this and you've never seen a check in person, you have to comment and let us know, because I got to see if there are people out there that exist that have never seen a check.
I mean, I think we're getting to the possibility of that.
I want to see. I want this to be a watermark.
I still have a checkbook. I don't think I've written a check in like 2 years.
It's true. I block it. People are like, oh, we only do it by check. I'm like, Really? Come on.
Really?
The food truck now uses cards. I mean, the food truck.
It's funny because now we see a bunch of places they only take card, right? They don't take cash, which is technically illegal because the cash on the note says good for all debts within the United States. So just throwing that out there.
All sporting events.
Well, and that's funny because you go to the Ranger Stadium or the Rangers ballpark and they have reverse ATMs.
Yes. Goes from cash to card.
Yeah, you could put cash in and it spits you out like a, you know, a Visa or whatever.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
You know, a gift card effectively. But they don't take cash at the stands anymore.
The hockey arena here in Columbus does that too.
Yeah.
As I imagine other places now.
Just moving slowly toward our cashless society where your money is just a bunch of ones and zeros in a computer that is very fallible and written and runs on software written by very fallible humans.
Well, good luck. Cash was fallible too with forgers.
Yeah, that too. Slash hackers.
Yeah. Anyways.
So we've established our job here, right? We've got our conceit. We've got our tunes living with humans. We have our PI, who's a standard PI because he's drunk, because he likes his iced tea, and that he's got his very expensive job. Which it doesn't tip him off that somebody's willing to pay him basically $1,500 to take a few pictures.
Right.
Maroon balks at it, right? But he ends up paying him, or half of it, at least up front.
Well, you know, that's the thing with private eyes. Like if, and this is kind of the stereotype of private eyes, that that's basically what they do is they go spy on people, in particularly, you know, rich housewives and things like that, and get paid absurd amounts of money to go tell them what they're doing wrong.
And the reality is most of what they do is insurance fraud.
Yeah.
Insurance fraud investigations. That seems to be the bread and butter of your average private eye.
That's the start of our plot. But you got to think that if he's doing this and he was asked to come there, that he's got a reputation so that he must have work. And therefore, if he has work, he's got money. We'll come to find out he doesn't have any money because as he's leaving the studio, he goes and tries to get on the trolley, the street trolley. And to try to get on, he just shows the ticket taker the check. And the ticket taker just looks back at him and goes, "What am I, a bank?"
And hilariously, that's one of the great lines from this movie. Or it's one I remember very distinctly.
Right. Yeah.
One of the great memorable lines. "What am I, a bank?" Just the way he delivers the line, shuts the door in his face, the trolley system.
Instead of getting on the trolley, you know, inside the trolley, he hitches a ride on the back.
Yeah.
On the bumper. And in fact, he's back there with two kids. And the two kids are yelling at the running behind him, "Hey, come on, come on." And Bob is egging the kid on, trying to help him get on.
Ends up helping him, grabs him, and helps him get on the back of the trolley, the bumper.
I didn't even see this the first time, but if you watch really closely, because I didn't catch it because I wasn't looking at the kids start pulling out smokes.
Oh, yeah.
And then when he gets to his place, you know, you see Bob Hoskins holding the cigarette saying, "Hey, thanks for the smoke."
Yeah, thanks for the smokes. It's, you know, these are like 10-year-olds.
An older generations want to yell at us for how we raise kids.
You're right. And it's interesting the interchange you get between Valiant and the kids. It's all about, you know, this is LA. We've got the best public transit system in the world here.
Right.
"Don't you have a car, mister?" And that becomes like, it's sort of the framework of what's going on really in the background, because he gets off the trolley and you see it used to be like Sunset Electric or something.
You called it like the red car.
Oh, yeah. The red line, the red car. Yeah. Because all the cars are red.
Right.
And you see going up over it, over the original sign is a Cloverfield, right? Cloverfield Enterprise. Mm-hmm. And what we find out is he goes into the bar and meets some of the guys, and one of the guys is mute, I guess. He doesn't talk.
Right.
He's got a little notepad.
But he was asking about the guy that was passed out drunk, and you can see, you know, Valiant puts his trolley hat on, and he asks what happened to Earl, and that's when, yeah, the mute guy says, you know, he got laid off.
One of the other guys starts talking about, yeah, that's this new outfit that bought the whole line, Cloverfield. It's one of those like background conversations in a bar that you think is maybe just window dressing, but it turns out to be kind of the real plot going on in the background that you don't even realize at this point.
You know, he tries to give a toast to Earl and says, you know, "Here's to the pencil pushers. May they all get lead poisoning."
It's another great line.
Well, it's a typical 1940s, you know, blue collar kind of line, you know.
Yeah.
Blue collar saying, hope the white collars, you know, all die from the ink and lead that they use all the time.
Yeah.
Instead of the hard labor. And then, you know, as he tries to take the shot, you see a woman's hand go over his shot glass, and, you know, and she goes, hey, it's Friday. You know what happens on Friday? And he goes, no, the fish special.
Yeah. Which, it being Lent, is appropriate.
Well, and it's funny because, you know, for people who were deathly afraid of Catholics taking over, that seemed to be the one thing that just carried throughout America pretty much, you know, forever, is fish on Friday.
Well, I mean, it was a major business point for McDonald's, because the original McDonald's were in heavily Catholic populated areas. And so their sales would drop so dramatically on Fridays that it was affecting the overall business model.
That's right.
So they had to come up with something and it ended up being the fillet of fish.
Well, it almost wasn't. It was a competition.
Yes.
Between a fish sandwich and the original owners of McDonald's, or the original owner of McDonald's. I wouldn't say the original, but the guy that we know, I can't remember his name now, originally said he didn't want fish because he didn't want the fishy smell in his restaurants.
Yeah.
So he had a competition between the fish sandwich and like a pineapple sandwich. And I don't know why he thought that would work, but it really didn't. And he's like, all right, fish is on the menu now.
Oh, no, it's not only that it really didn't. The guy who was piloting the fish sandwich sold as many fillet of fishes as he did cheeseburgers on a normal day.
Right.
And the guy selling the pineapples sold zero.
Like none.
Like none. It was the Aloha burger, I want to say, something like that. So fish on Fridays, that was a standard business model for a lot of restaurants, especially in heavily Catholic areas, because that's what we ate on Friday. And it wasn't just it's a fairly recent change that we've gone from every Friday just to Fridays in Lent. But it used to be every Friday. It still is, if you want it to be.
Oh, of course. I mean, yeah. Well, that's why a lot of restaurants throughout the country, you'll see, will hold fish fries on Friday.
Yeah.
Churches, what do you call them? Not moose lodges, like rotary clubs and places like that, you know, Shriners.
Oh, the Knights of Columbus.
Guaranteed.
Columbus, yeah. If your parish has a Knights of Columbus, they're doing a fish fry during Lent. Guaranteed. So everyone everywhere does it.
But getting back to the movie.
Hey, this is what you're paying for.
That's right. This is what you're paying for.
It's kind of in-depth over analysis that you've come to know and love over the 5 years of Pat and the Fat Man. FM stuff here.
You can either pay us to shut us up or pay us to keep talking about it. Your choice. Let us know. Your choice.
Yeah. We do what we're told.
But she goes, no, smart. And she doesn't call him smart. She said, no, my boss checks the books and I better get that money from you. Otherwise, you know, I'm going to be out on a job. And he's like, oh, I got something in the works.
So this conversation, like, it's an important conversation for later when you learn what their relationship is, where the bar came from. It's an important conversation. You don't realize it, honestly, until you watch the movie a second time. Mm-hmm. It sort of just leads into the trope that he's a kind of a bum, likes his tea a little too much and doesn't pay his bills. And you think, okay, this is just more PI tropism, but this is actually kind of a bellwether for their relationship and where it's at by the time the movie takes place in comparison to what we see later on, where their relationship was like when they started the bar.
Right. He shows her the check, where he's getting the money from. He asked for her camera. You know, first she's reluctant. He's like, hey, you want the other $50 that I owe you? You know, you got to give me the camera. And he shows her the check and just to make sure she knows that it's real money and whatnot. And then in walks in the jerk.
Yeah. He's an interesting character. He's sort of maybe not a lot of smarts to him.
He's just supposed to be like your jerk. He's supposed to be your bully, you know?
Yeah.
And he's making fun of Valiant working for a cartoon company and starts listing off all these different cartoon names, you know, and whatnot. You know, the guy makes a comment about, you know, oh, you're working for Little Bo Peep, you know, naming a cartoon. At that point,
would she lose her sheep?
Right. Yeah. Valiant kicks his chair out from under him and says, you know, listen, I don't work for Toons, and shoves his hard-boiled egg into his mouth, shoves his face into the bar.
Yeah, he comes up peeling these hard-boiled eggs, which I got to admit, I've never seen anybody do that ever at a bar. What's wrong with hard-boiled eggs?
No.
Hard-boiled eggs. Although sometimes they keep him at bars in pickle jars.
In pickle jars, yes.
The black egg. Yeah, everybody take an egg.
Whoever gets the black egg is the designated driver. The
driver.
That was Barney, right?
Yep. Duff Beer fully supports the designated driver program. Now, who's ready to party?
So when the bully gets up and is like, what's his problem? And you find out from Dolores that a cartoon had killed Valiant's brother.
Yeah.
And of course, in tune fashion, dropped a piano on his head.
Just the ridiculousness of that set of lines doesn't make it past her delivery.
Right.
Because you think about a tune killed this guy and when you dropped the piano on his head. Like,
at this point, if you haven't bought into the story, then you probably won't for the rest of it. But say that you did. I'll say that I did. Then that becomes more of a serious thing because then all of a sudden, well, not all tunes are nice. A lot of them aren't even nice to be funny. They're just homicidal. And so that was kind of the seriousness that not all tunes are funny. Not all tunes are good.
Right.
This is the aftermath of one tune having done something bad.
You get a couple little hints about that up to this point. That when he passes the ostrich and she like turns her nose up at him.
Like, you know. And, well, that was more of a like, you know, I'm too pretty to be bothered by you.
Right. Exactly. There's, you know, but it's still kind of this funny tuneness to right. it.
Oh, and then the hippo yeah. when he's coming down the stairs and, you know, she sits on the bench and the guy goes flying in the air.
You never hear him like coming down. He's just right, gone. Just,
he never comes down.
Yeah, just flying upwards for forever. But her delivery of this, and it's had to be hard for her. I can't imagine that actress not having laughed at least a couple times when she did this take. But it's delivered so well that it's not, you never think, oh, this is ridiculous. Because by this point, you're right. You've bought into the conceit. You know, tunes are real. They're actors. They're just like normal people, right?
Right.
Quite literally, the protagonist of the show is currently being paid money to take pictures of one of the tunes' wives acting badly, you know, to put it in the, because even Valiant's a little like, really? About this.
Well, and then when we get to the acting badly part, that's a bit funny, you know?
Yes. Do we move from this scene to the nightclub?
Yes. And it's an instant transition. You know, it goes from like late afternoon, early evening to after dark. And that's the thing about this movie, I want to say, is that it has its moments and chunks a little bit here and there and with good transitions. Like what we just saw in the bar, I think that's just a really good transition scene because you delve a little bit deeper into these characters' lives. You know, like Eddie Valiant, not only is he a drunk, he's in trouble with money. He has a girlfriend that, you know, is getting tired of his, you know, of his antics, you know, and then guys that don't respect him and how he deals with guys that don't respect him.
Right. You know, this acts as the introduction to both who Roger Rabbit is, mm-hmm. you know, kind of this goofy, zany sort of tune. And then to who Eddie Valiant is and
right.
what his relationships are with the people he interacts with at this point in time.
And it's so funny because you would think that Roger Rabbit is the main star because his name's in the title. Really, it's Eddie Valiant.
Oh, yeah. He is by far.
Roger Rabbit is really just kind of the protagonist, I guess.
Well, he's not. He's not. Eddie Valiant's the protagonist. Roger Rabbit's sort of the driving.
The catalyst.
But it's really not even right. You know, Who Framed Roger Rabbit is the driving catalyst, right? That's what cracks the nutshell.
You know what's funny going through this whole thing? Like, I'm kind of curious as to who framed him, but I'm just like, I don't care who framed him. I mean, you could tell me, but I want to know how we get there to finding him and what happens after, you know?
Well, and that's just it. Like, there's nothing at this point. There's no frame, right? Mm-hmm. It's just PI being hired to take some pictures of a dude's wife acting badly. Like, there's, you know, and you're like, okay. So even the title, it hasn't come into play yet. It's done so well, the scene setups, because we go from, you know, the classic film noir scenes that explain who the main players are into the scene where you move into the seedy underbelly of the city. Mm. In this case, is this nightclub where I love how Maroon explains it. It's a tune review that's humans only.
Right.
It's very reminiscent of a lot of bars and clubs that were only for certain kinds of people.
Right.
You know, there were a lot of jazz clubs in Harlem that were whites only. And even though all of the bands were, you know, African-Americans, and when you go back to that time period, it sort of boggles the mind. And yeah, yeah, you get all the signs, you know, running around, no Irish allowed kind of a thing. Yeah, no Irish help wanted kind of a deal. And you get that sort of feel that tunes have the same kind of stigma on them. And that Eddie Valiant is kind of on that side.
Right.
You know, what does the guy have against Toons? Well, Toon killed his brother.
Right.
It's an interesting play on this concept of the racism when applied to a group that is not really a race, right?
Well, I think it's more of showing the darker side of cartoons.
Yeah.
Because think about it. We just got done learning that a cartoon killed a human being. Then we find out that some tunes perform at nightclubs that are exclusive nightclubs. You have to have special password to get in. And it's just the performers are just the tunes. And then there's regular people in there as patrons. And so it's more of a perversion kind of thing, you know, because it's not in broad daylight. It's not like, you know, people just go there during the day and whatnot. No, you have to have the secret password to get in. So clearly it's not something they want. They think that everybody would be accepting of.
Yeah.
Otherwise they just let everybody in.
Yeah.
And so you're kind of seeing that it is an integrated world, because just like in the real world, there are places that are good and there are places that are bad, or at least places that some people think are bad.
Right. Even nowadays, there are certain parts of cities that I'm not going to go into. They're not for me.
Well, there's certain clubs that you're not going to go into. Not only that they're not for you, but you would be worried about what people would think of you if you went into them.
That's the other piece of it, right?
Right.
And in that vein, it has a very similar feel to kind of the whole Red Scare stuff that started in the decade after this, which would be, you know, you would go to these clubs with quote unquote known communists or whatever, and you didn't want anybody else to know you were there because it could get you put on a list and blacklisted in Hollywood. So it does have kind of, you know, these little inklings of things we see in the real world, which again just makes the conceit seem more real. It draws you into it, even though what we end up getting in the bar is so ridiculous. It's about as, like, you know, single entendre as you could possibly get. It's not even double. We're not even going to go that far. Nice monkey suit. Wise ass.
So that's the thing. We're only 15 minutes into this. So, you know, jump ahead a couple of minutes, 16, 17 minutes. And we've got a third line in this movie that's just perfect, you know. Yeah. And the response, too, you know. A cartoon saying something like what he does, and we'll get to that. You know, I know we're jumping ahead a little bit, but
yeah. No, we'll say it again next time. So next time we'll be moving into the bar scene, but for now we'd like to point you to our website, patandthefatman.com. Remember, we're on Facebook, so share the podcast as loudly and as broadly as you can. Friends, family, and anybody you meet on the street, just hand it out, whoever you can, because that's how podcasts get around, is by word of mouth.
Facebook, X, Instagram. X is the Fat Man 1238. Instagram, Pat and the Fat Man. Like Pat said, like, follow, and share. If you feel like contributing more, and like you said, either talking more or less about certain things, give us some money, add quotes into it at our Patreon page, which the link for that is on our website, right? Patandthefatman.com.
Patandthefatman.com. There's a little button that says Patreon. It's right above the larger button that says Amazon Music, which I'll probably get rid of that. and just make the Patreon button bigger. But yes, if you want to hear us talk about anything in specific or don't want to hear us talk about stuff, become a patron, because we do what our patrons tell us. Just ask Kelso. He basically has four or five shows we've done just because he told us to do them. So if you want, you know, control over what we talk about, talk to Kelso, or talk to Kelso, become a patron. $1 a month. That's all it takes. You know, we'll take 5 or 10 or 20, you know, however much you want to give us. And the reality is it doesn't go to us. It goes to our editor that makes this listening experience that is enjoyable, because the God's honest truth is if you listen to us raw, there's a lot that she covers up.
Whose fault could that be, huh, Pat?
All I have to say about right, that.
I can't believe you would say that. I mean, just terrible. I mean, children listen to this, man.
All right. Well, on that note, I'm Pat.
I'm the Fat Man.
Stay classy.
Tunes.
When did the war end?
45. September of 45 is when World War II ended.
I'm a middle-aged man. I should know that.
Oh, yeah, yeah. That meme. Boy, we're going to have a talk with Dirty Sanchez about that one. He posted a meme that said that you're in your 40s, you're either really into World War II history or smoking meat. I responded, hey, man, don't put me in a box, all right?
I mean, can it be both?
Right, right. That's what I'm saying. I'm into way more things, okay? We don't even want to get started on my web history, all right?
We're just going to move past that.